Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Ask Unity podcast, episode 92. For those of you new to the show, I'm comedian Simon Kane, and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, talent agencies. Mike Lee is the founder of MLA Talent. They're not just a talent agency though, they also produce a lot of free digital content and media online, particularly in podcasts, where they own their own podcast network to share audiences. I got him on to talk about how he represents his acts both on and off stage and on and offline, and how their online audiences have translated to offline audiences. This interview would be really good for any act looking to develop an online audience, or someone who already has an online audience but wants to try and translate it to a real world one and doesn't really know how to do it. It'll also be good for anyone who's trying to find an agent, and this is full of advice on the do's and don'ts and the things that annoy him and annoy all agents in their capacity and the job that they do. Thank you very much to JD Henshaw from the Suites venue, and the whole Suites venue in fact, for giving me a quiet place to record this show. I think it was at 9 a.m. I think at one point in the interview Mike points out it is bloody early. I got up very early every day to record these. So if you'd like to thank JD or the Suites venue, there are links in the show notes or you can Google them. Please do say thank you, because it does show that there is an appreciative audience out there, and frankly it's a lovely thing to do. So thank you very much, JD. If you're new here, please do hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do consider giving us an honest review in iTunes. They really help the show. Seriously, take a minute, write something nice. Doesn't have to be particularly long. That's what she said. I'm better than that. I can't believe I said that. Just basically, you'd think I would have edited that out. Just do a review. That would really appreciate it. But for now, without any more delays, this is Mike Lee.
My drive for setting up MLA and leaving the other agencies I worked for was to basically work for myself and work the hours I wanted to do and earn the money that I was actually bringing in. That's kind of why I think most people eventually set up by themselves. I think most people obviously start at agencies, bigger agencies or whatever, and then get to a stage when you sort of think, you know what, I just want to do this myself, and hopefully, depending on what deals you've done, take the clients that you've kind of found and nurtured with you and do it that way, really. I think, you know, a lot of you sort of look at all the sort of what I call big individual agents rather than the massive companies. Everyone kind of ends up doing that, really, at some stage.
Okay, and if I were to say, what makes you different, if you were to like pitch it to performers, if right. they wanted to work with you, what where do you see yourself within?
Well, I think I'm quite a hands-on agent. I think I do more than just, you know, negotiating deals, looking for work, that kind of thing. I think with a lot of my clients, I kind of produce some of their work. We're here in Edinburgh, and there's a couple of shows on that I'm producer of as well. So I get quite involved if I think it's necessary. If an artist is at a certain level or we're trying to shift what they're doing, I do tend to get quite hands-on and involved. So I think I'm sort of, I wouldn't say I'm a manager, but I think I'm sort of in the middle between an agent and a manager for a lot of my, not so much actors, but a lot of my comedy performers. I think the ones who are sort of doing their own thing rather than, you know, learning someone else's script and showing up for a job. For ones who are doing Edinburgh or comedy shows and tours and characters, quite hands-on.
And when you say like trying to help them with their direction. Is it? Would you say that you work for them or they work for you? How does that dynamic work?
It's a good question. I've always kind of seen it as a collaborative thing. I never understand when I speak to sort of any kind of performers who sort of go, oh, you know, oh, I'm scared when I call my agent. Oh, I never speak to my agent. I only speak to my assistant. I'm thinking, why? When you first sat down and decided to work together, didn't you kind of agree at that level what, you know, you say to protect a client, what's your goal? What's your aim? Where do you want to be? You know, then you're honest and go, yep, I can help with that. Or, no, not my world. So I see it as a collaborative thing. I just see it as it's something you do together, really.
So based on that, what would you say you... probably a better question here would be, what do you say you don't do? Because what you do...
What I don't do... I mean, I did many years ago when I started out, but I sort of draw the line at being that kind of agent stroke manager that is on call 24 hours a day. You know, oh, I've got locked out. Oh, I'm stuck at this bar. Can you get me into this party? Can you do that? That kind of hands-on manager stuff I steer clear of. I've had it before with certain clients and realised this is not for me. I'm not doing this. So I think that's kind of where I draw the line when it comes to that kind of personal stuff of, can you sort me out? Oh, I need a plumber and all that kind of stuff, which some sort of managers obviously have to do. They have to get involved with those sort of things. But I try and keep it, you know, kind of strictly professional.
And in terms of your remit of professionalism of stuff, do you, like, so obviously you do stuff with TV and radio and podcasting and obviously comedy, the live circuit. Are there any areas that you would say you're working towards being more or stronger in the next year or two? That,
I mean, one thing that I haven't kind of, although I'm kind of involved in with the podcasting, but, you know, one area which I want to develop is the whole, you know, the YouTuber blogging kind of stuff. My wife is, funny enough, now become a full-time blogger, funny enough. She was on my books as an actress, bizarrely. She's now found an outlet for that by doing this blogging. So I knew that I didn't have enough experience to find her sponsors to do Facebook Live and brands to come on board. So, you know, she's going to a company that just specializes in YouTube kind of talent, which is a very different thing because, you know, in comedy, someone could be hilarious in their living room, in their bedroom, put them up on stage and do stuff, and it's a different kettle of fish. I mean, obviously, there's people like Limmy that have done brilliantly from literally starting in the bedroom. But there's a lot out there that you sort of think, yeah, once you're in front of an audience, it's a very sort of different thing. So that's one area, absolutely, I think most agencies will be looking to develop because it's still the Wild West. Still, people don't quite know where that whole thing is going to go, but it's absolutely, look at the figures alone, with TV figures and radio figures going down, it's absolutely the way forward, where an individual will not need a broadcaster. They will be the broadcaster, they will be the brand, they'll go directly to their fans. That's what will happen in this industry.
And you run a podcast network?
Yes, I do, called Playback Media. We started off, my business partner started off, he had a company called Whippet, which was they were the first British download company, almost before Apple and around the same time as Napster. And obviously they got eaten up because iTunes was so massive. So he built a little kind of radio station, little radio sort of desk, and got Danny Baker in to do a sort of first, it was the all-day breakfast show for a little while. And we had this studio, and I was obviously looking after artists. And he sort of said, you know, any ideas? I went, well, I'm being a big football fan, and I'm working with Phil Cornwell, who's also a big football fan. Cornwell from Stella Street's fame, Gilbert's Fridge. We sort of said, let's just do a podcast about Spurs. And 10 years on, we've now got 15, 16 weekly podcasts, mainly celebrity presented football podcasts, but we do some comedy ones. We've got the Angelos and Barry show, which is Dan Skinner and Angelos Epithemou and Alex Lowe's Barry from Watford, which from the podcast has spawned a tour now, UK tour. So yeah, that's another side that I'm sort of interested in.
And where something that we were talking about just briefly before we started is sponsorships and promotions, trying to get those monetized. Because obviously, as you said, everyone's scrambling for attention at the moment in media particularly. And I think there's a lot of mistrust in mainstream at the moment. And so like sort of podcasts and vloggers and stuff seem to be sort of monopolizing some of the attention that might have traditionally gone to maybe newspapers or magazines and stuff. What do you feel is like the reason why people maybe invest in, so for example?
Well, I'm not too sure they are yet. I still think it's early days. There's a resurgence of podcasts. They were obviously big a while back, all went quiet, and now there's a big resurgence for them, especially in America, where they have monetized it much better. And it's a bit like, if you watch TV, you're just used to some adverts. Now when you watch YouTube, it used to be so annoying. It's still annoying, but you used to just have to sit through that advert. And now with podcasts, you know, when we started, when we put our first adverts, people were like, oh no, there's an advert on your podcast. You're getting this for free. How do you think we're all here sitting here paying for it? So people kind of used to it. And I don't think it's sort of, It's great for performers who are tired of waiting to be commissioned for this or get a radio show for this. You know, you look at the big comment, you know, Richard Herring, prime example. Brilliant talent, been around a long, long time. You know, I'm just going to do this myself. And he's monetized it. I assume he makes the money from the live shows he does. It's funny, it always goes back to live. I mean, the podcast we do, our biggest revenue stream is still the live shows. So with the Spurs show we do, we're going to one live show a month, actually. And, you know, some of those, depending on the guest, the last one we had, the ex-manager, Harry Redknapp, we had 350 people paying £30 each. So it's sort of far more than we're getting in advert money through, you know, companies that you deal with who drop in adverts. But it's, as I said, people sort of used to it, and it just gives you a bit more control. But again, don't do podcasts out there unless you've got a real love and a real passion to do something, because I think I see now there's a slight movement to performers doing not like this, which is talking about the industry, but let's do a funny podcast together, and not quite knowing what the market is, who's going to listen to it, how they're going to hear it. It's tough. It's tough to start now because, as you know, there's so many out there. And it's a bit like, you know, trying to find a video on YouTube. Where do you start? What do you look for? So I think it's a bit like the Wild West. There's loads out there, and I think it will sort of settle down. And the ones that can monetize it, maybe do a live show, maybe a bit of merchandising, maybe could morph into more of a radio thing or a TV thing or a webcast thing, will be the ones that kind of survive, I think.
Yeah, I think what I found most interesting in especially in podcasting, let's start with YouTube. The people that I started watching 10 years ago on YouTube, I think the videos I started finding them through wouldn't make it through now to the front page. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Because the front page of YouTube originally was just individual creator content that was really interesting to the person who was creating it.
But YouTube have got much more hands-on now. I mean, they'll do deals once you get, it's 5,000 or 10,000 or 15,000 subscribers. Once you get to that level, you know, they will do deals with you, just use their studios in town and get on with it. So that's kind of a good thing in a way to propel stuff. But then other people who don't get to that level, who are really niche, you know, kind of stay in their bedroom. But, you know, again, I think, like, look, I'm sure we'll talk about comedy later. No one should go into this business thinking they're going to make a fortune. You do it for the love, and you do it because it's a calling. It's something within you that you want to do. Don't sit down and go, right, I'm going to be a comedian to make lots of money. Sadly, a lot do. Or I'm going to do a podcast because I'm going to make a fortune. It's the wrong reason for doing it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of the things that stands out for me is I get a lot of messages from people saying, oh, how do you start a podcast? How do you do this? Just because of the nature of this show. Mm. And one person, I told them, I gave them a list of the sort of, I've got a thing on my website that shows you how to start one. And in it, they just went, yeah, I just don't know. I'm going to find like an hour and a half a week to record it. I was like, okay. It's more the edit time you need to be worried about at this point, mate. Like, that's the time killer. Like, not the recording time.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe don't start one now then, because it just feels like you're not into this. Yeah. And it's a ball.
It sounds like he wants you to do it for him, I think.
Maybe, but I'm not. Yeah. I've got enough editing to do in my life. But it's just that sort of thing where you think to yourself, you know, what's getting you out of bed to make you want to do that? Like, what's your actual drive to do that? Because to create a quality podcast, I think it's easier to get the equipment and to get it up online, I think, than it's ever been. But I think with that, you've sort of got people who maybe don't want they're not sort of invested in it in a positive way.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you know there's bigger companies that produce podcasts. You can sort of see the ones where they've thrown two people together because they think there'll be sort of synergy and whatever, and there isn't. And you can always hear in the people's voices, they don't quite know why they're there, but they've been told a podcast is a good thing to do. Again, I just don't think that's the right reason to do it. But brands, I mean, it happens a lot. A brand will come, oh, we're, you know, whoever, we want to get this one, that one, here's some money. And so people will kind of do it, but not, you know, literally for the money, but not as much in that yet.
So when you're looking, so if you're scouting for talent to bring on,
on podcasts? Are we still talking podcasts?
We can talk both. Like, okay, I don't know how much overlap there is between the two. Mm. But I was wondering if you're scouting for a talent for MLA, or you want to look for another podcast. How much do you take into account, like, their social following or their social?
You have to a lot. I mean, with Playback, with the podcast, you know, we do. I mean, most of them we have started from scratch, don't get me wrong, but when we're bringing one in that's already up and running, we bring it under the banner, we need to kind of know, you know, how many downloads they're getting, so we can then immediately tell them, right, on that level you should be bringing in X a month. We can cross promote your show with we've got one called Geek Town, which does very well. We can cross promote, put adverts on that. You know, we need to have a sort of sense of where they are and where it can go. I mean, it's With the football ones we do, you know, Manchester United I'm not a fan, but are probably the biggest team in the world. That one is not our biggest podcast, and half their listeners are in the US, which when it comes to UK advertising is an utter waste of time. You're sort of like, I can't believe we already bought X in this month, because most are overseas. We've got one Glasgow Rangers one called Heart and Hand, which gets about 10,000-12,000 listeners a week, and the engagement is unbelievable. Their Facebook page is vibrant, their Twitter page is vibrant. They just get on with it. They're just absolutely fantastic. So each one is kind of different, and it's got to be, going back to the original question, I think it's got to be that presenter, the person who's doing it, it's got to have that drive. It's, you know, we've got a few shows where, you know, a well-known presenter will just show up and do it, but the best ones are the ones where they're getting their booking their own guests, they're having ideas for their shows. If it comes from within, I just think it's always a better product.
Oh, definitely. And so that's how you'd scout for like a new podcast. Mm. And if you were scouting for a new client, a live client, for example, or an acting client, or something like that, where do you even look for those?
Well, there's different things. I mean, on an acting side of things, when you're just putting them up for, you know, acting jobs, we'll look at our client list and see what we're lacking. You know, if there's a huge, you know, amount of looking for Iraqi actor, whatever, I'll go out and try and find an Iraqi actor so we can suggest that person for work. With comedy, it doesn't work like that way. I have to work with people that make me laugh. I there's probably many agents out there who will go, don't make me laugh, but I know I can make money out of them. I have to have someone that I really believe in and think they're really, really funny to work with them. You have to have that joy and passion when you see them, because I think when you then talk about your client to industry types, that comes across. And if they know you, they know, well, this guy's not bullshitting me, he clearly loves this act, yeah, come on, yeah, we're going to see him tonight, type thing. So that can come from just people contacting me and me just being in a club and seeing someone and thinking, oh, this guy's interesting or she's interesting. It's hard to tell early on, because, as you know, there's loads of comics, so I think, you know, have a tight 10 minutes that's really, really good. But it's like, how do they develop to the 20 minutes? They've got to get the club gigs, which is not that easy anymore, because there aren't many out there that pay or get big audiences, sadly, to the next level of coming up and doing an hour show in Edinburgh, which, as you know, is a completely different discipline. I think there's too many comedians out there that are getting signed by agencies way before they're ready, way before they need an agent. And I think it's kind of ruining the business, really. I mean, you look at all the kind of, you know, well-known TV famous comedians, the majority of them in their 40s, 50s, a comedian needs time and experience to to live a bit of a life in order to make jokes about it, you know, largely. So it's sometimes it's hard to, I mean, I've had a few over the years that I've seen them, bless him, there was one that I think was Stuart Lee first mentioned to Sarah Fowle, who used to work at Comedy Central many years ago. This was 98. There was a little pub down from the Pleasance something tree. It's, I don't know. They do comedy there, but it says you go down. No, it's not the Pear Tree. Okay. It's literally on the same road as you go down from the Preston Cross. Where there used to be a pub there, and there's a great comedy space there. They had a lot of great shows there. I was taken to. It became the sort of comedian's favourite in joke. There was a. There was an actor, his name was Dr. Coca-Cola McDonald's, and he was a guy, he was a teacher, supply teacher from Leicester or Derby, whose act was playing a Bontempi organ, really weird ditty songs, wearing nothing but a pair of Speedos and a clown face. And it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And that was one just going, I don't know what this is, but let's go with it. But, you know, we managed to get him on Richard Webb, who's a well-known comedy producer, was doing a show called... It was a BBC Three thing, comedy. It was one of those compilation shows with different acts thrown together and never quite works. But he was a sort of regular on that. So you never know. Sometimes they might have... I mean, I've always quite liked the weird cabaret acts. You know, I've got Frank Sinatra, the Ubermeister of Lounge. He's obviously well known. Tina Turner, Tea Lady, another brilliant comic creation. So there's some that will just... This is the act. This is what they do. Mm. It's not going to develop. That's your gag. Yeah. You know, it's very different to a comedian who will, you know... develop his work and his material.
I couldn't do character stuff. I got
right, really, it's interesting.
Yeah, I got a review the other day that said his persona, like they were going on about my persona.
It's me. I was like persona.
I was like, come hang out with me for 20 minutes. Yeah. You'll see, this is not a persona. I'm quite anxious. All
I'd
the
use
time.
That. I'd use that. And go, yeah, this is persona. I'm not like this at home.
Yeah, yeah. At home, I'm so chill. Like at home, I don't even give it. I don't even whatever. No, it was such a weird moment because, like, you know, when you get reviewed and you get told something about yourself that isn't true, but they think it is because of what they've seen on.
But this is how the people might see you, Simon. This is it. People just think you're one big act.
Yeah, you know what? I'd prefer it if they thought it was. Because I'm telling you now, I do me, and that's it. But I have friends who do character acts and stuff, and I find it really amazing that, because you talk to them and they talk about it like it is another person.
But isn't that the act? That's the mask, isn't it? That's the comedy mask that you can hide behind and get away with murder that you never do or say yourself on stage.
Yeah.
It's not me. It's my creation. Yeah. And that's why so many comedians do it.
Well, the thing, I couldn't do that. Like, if I'm going to go on stage and do a joke that is potentially offensive in a whatever way, I'm not going to go, my nan said this. Like, I'm not going to hide behind some sort of whatever. I'd rather just go, I had this thought. Let's see if you like it too. Because it just seems really disingenuous. But if you have put the effort in to make a character up that has the sort of conceit that will hold it and keep it going, I think fair play to you. If you've got that imagination and you think you can... build a world that someone can be pulled into.
Absolutely.
I can't do it. I've just got my own head and I'm struggling with that. Yeah. So. you said that if like they were looking for like an Iranian actor or like an Indian actor or something like that, you'd go out and look for one. How much are you really affected by quotas then in terms of comedy?
What do you mean by quotas?
So like, say, like with the BBC when they brought out that thing where they said, oh, we need one woman on every panel show, or, you know, like, how much does that really affect your day?
It doesn't. It goes back to what I said earlier about I sign people I'm genuinely excited about. You can't second guess what TV people want. I mean, you know, TV people don't know what they want until something they rejected has done well on another channel, you know, whereby we know sketch shows are gone now. Oh, YTV had a Vegas sketch. Let's do a sketch show or panel show. Or let's do. You can't run your own business just thinking about what, you know, obviously it's important. You know, you need to suggest people, but you can't sort of second guess what or what they might ask for. You just got to have talent with you, and it's cyclical. Things come around, and you know, your people, you've got writers on your books that are brilliant writing sketches, and there's no sketch shows for 3-4 years, and eventually, oh look, some sketch shows now. Dust off those old scripts, you know, change that, it's not Blair anymore, you know, change that line, and then they go. So you know, it's very difficult otherwise.
Yeah. It sounds like it affects you more in the acting field than anything else because they're casting for a specific.
Yeah, I mean, with that, this is it. It's all about, you know, sadly, with a lot of acting jobs, it's all about the look. You might be, God, there's thousands of talented actors out there that don't get a chance because they don't look right for a particular role. It's that's it. If you're going up for, you might be Iraqi, but with ginger hair, you're not going to get the American drama playing the Iraqi because you're not sterically typically Iraqi looking. Forget about it. That's the way it goes. But I think most actors sort of realise that and realise the strengths they have to sort of work towards in order to get work.
Mm. Yeah. But like you said, you know, I think it would help if that actor had a following on YouTube or on a
podcast. Well, comedy's going that way, as we touched on before, with certain YouTubers you see show up on panel shows or reality shows, and you're like, who's this? And they go, oh, million subscribers. Oh, so you're TV, and you're now trying to tap into the internet to get people to move away from the internet to come and watch you. Oh, that's cynical. Okay. You know, and that's it. I mean, it's staggering that's happening now. You know, you sort of think, God, where would certain greats of yesteryear be if they're around today? I mean, really, would Morecambe and Wise get on television now if they, you know, had to have a successful YouTube channel pranking away at home? These people, you know, with Tommy Cooper, you know, it's terrible magic, terrible, it doesn't work. I mean, where would they be now if they had to come through the YouTube generation? We wouldn't see these greats, yeah. You know. You can argue, are we going to see those kind of greats again? I don't know.
No, it's the same thing, like I said before, where the people I found originally on YouTube wouldn't make it to the front page or the trending now. Mm. You think these gems that managed to make it through, but then there were less people, I suppose, and it was less saturated and
yeah, but also because there's less clubs where people can develop their work. I mean, I've got a client here called Chris McGlade, who's brilliant, who's doing... is it Just the Tonic, 11 p.m. every night, and he has come from absolutely from Teesside, the northern working class comedy circuit, which he's been doing for 28 years, and now he's trying to, well, he's absolutely changed his material, and it's quite political now and thought provoking, but he's got that stagecraft. He can be in front of 200 people, and he's got 28 years of experience of doing some god awful places after the bingo and before the, you know, the meat raffle or whatever, but he's had the stage time. And you sort of think of people coming through now. Where do you get decent stage time to develop stuff, especially like more variety and double acts and stuff? I know there's the sort of open mic circuit, but you know, it's like, oh, it's so difficult. And then when you've got, you know, we're here now at the Edinburgh Festival, and at the end of the festival, you have the TV festival, and TV people come up, or who should we see? It's a different medium. You then got to take someone who's brilliant live in front of 100 people at the Pleasance to go, okay, we now need to develop this into a TV piece and all that. But again, you know, there's not many, well, I wouldn't say this might be great, but yeah, but there's not many great comedy producers out there anymore, because just the work isn't there. Most have had to go freelance, you know, scratch for work. And again, you need that relationship to develop them. And I think when you get a name who's already established, oh, we've got so-and-so on our channel, producers are almost scared to go, that's not funny, doesn't work, for fear of losing their job. What are you saying that to the talent for? Let them do what they want to do. And that's why there's so much bad comedy on TV at the moment, because no one says to these people, no, this just doesn't work. I don't care who you are, this is not funny. I have more experience about you. I know what works on TV. That's your problem.
A lot of TV people, or a lot of the commissioners and people that I know in TV, say things like, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they'd come up to the Fringe, they'd see a show, they'd see how it could transfer to TV, and that's why they'd be looking at the award winners, because they'd go, you know what, that act we could put in this kind of variety show or this kind of...
There's too much now. I mean, I remember my sort of grounding in Edinburgh from 94 to 99 was working with a company called Polar Jones, no more, Stone Ranger, which was with Ed Smith, who's now Phil McIntyre, and my job was getting shows up and helping the acts. You know, I remember when, I mean, this is what, come on, it was 96, I'm off the top of my head. I remember Armstrong and Miller, who are unknown, that they were doing the Pleasant Studio, and they were getting 20, 30 people in the first week. Suddenly, 5 stars in the Scotsman when there was less shows. That was it. They never looked back. Now you'll get 5 stars in the Scotsman the last week and go, this is it. And people go, yeah, but there's another 40 shows that have also got 5 stars. So you still don't know what to go and develop. It was much easier then because there was less around. And now, because there's more, doesn't mean the quality's gone up. The quality's absolutely gone down. But, you know, for the same reason I said before, because people can't nurture the stuff. But now, look, it's great with the Free Fringe, and I'm running a Free Fringe venue, Frankenstein's on George IV Bridge. Some great shows. It's brilliant for performers now who can afford, it's still expensive, but afford now to come and try stuff out here. That didn't happen for years. But even that's shifting. There's so many big names now who can sell tickets, who are thinking, no, I'm going to do the Free Fringe as well because I want the money straight in my pocket. And I think kind of that's unfair, because the free fringe should be for acts who don't have the profile, who can't afford to do the pleasance and, you know, the gilded balloon, you know, and that's a slight worry. It's getting better because I think the quality of venues on the free fringe are getting better, but all those really good venues on the free fringe are now being taken over by acts that last year were doing the pleasance and the assembly rooms.
I'm torn on this because I've got a friend, he did the pleasance, the assembly last year. And I think it cost him about $12,000 to do the show last year.
Jesus Christ.
I know, right? And it was just an hour stand up. You know, obviously did all the, you know, billboard stuff that you have to do to kind of, you know.
No, you don't. I've never ever done it.
I know you don't.
That's a waste of money.
I should put out, I've never done one.
Yeah. And
I
don't. That's a waste of money.
But I feel like when you're doing a show at that profile, you might feel like you have to do it. And as everyone else is doing it, and if you're the one show at the venue that isn't doing it, you might feel a little bit like you're sort of lagging behind. So that's what I mean by you sort of have to do it. It's more in your head than anything else. You know, and this year this is on the free fringe.
Right. And I think, is that because last year cost them $12,000?
It was a big contributing factor because this year, you know, so the last show I did up here cost me about $2,200.
Not bad.
And it was on the free fringe.
That includes your accommodation?
Yeah, but I did rent a flat and then rent every room except for the bathroom.
Well done. But there you are. But that's do something on. I mean, I think still on average, even doing the free fringe with your accommodation and this and that, you're still looking at $4,000-$5,000.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
And that's without going out. You know.
Yeah.
Don't, you know, people don't factor that in. You know, at home, do you go out on the piss every night? No, but you do in Edinburgh. Mm. You've got to factor that in as well. But anyway, sorry, you were saying.
It's all right. That's why you're here. I was just saying, I can understand why if you're, I mean, the guy's like 6 years in, six, seven years in. And you know, if you're that far in and you wanted to do your hour, and I get it why you'd want to do it at a big venue, and it's, you know, it's nice to a boost to your ego, and it's like, oh, look, I'm around all these bigger comedians, all that kind of stuff. But I can understand why that might not appeal to a bigger comedian, because you might think, you know what, this is an extortionate price that I'm paying as well to be in this venue. Like, they're a great venue. Well,
there's a lot of big names that still, because of who they're with, sell out and still barely see a penny because of the cost of all the things you've just mentioned. But I think, again, you know, we live in this small comedy bubble, and there's a smaller comedy bubble, the Edinburgh comedy bubble. And when you speak, I mean, I've been doing the Fringe since 1989, when I ran a comedy magazine called The Heckler, which was the first sort of magazine just looking at comedy stand up then. God, it was a long time ago. And you know, it's still to this day, it's the locals that come out and buy the tickets. And years ago, the locals would come out to that first weekend 2-for-1 and see what was good. Now they'll go straight to the free shows, find some good free shows, tell all their mates, and we had last year shows that weren't well known sold out for the rest of their run because the locals had picked it up and it was free, and they put, you know, £5 a head in the bucket afterwards, which goes straight to the performer. You know, and if you're doing the assembly rooms at £10 a ticket, after the split, after that, you're going to end up with the same money in your pocket, but you're waiting till the end of September to see it, and you're not laying out a £3,000 guarantee to a venue whether anyone shows up or not. That's why it works so well, and that's why I know, and we've got artists in our venue who have for years did the paid venue and now do the free fringe because they're seeing more money. So I get why bigger acts are going to the free fringe. I still think it's kind of unfair. That's it. I know it's going to happen, and maybe more venues will spring up and other deals are done or whatever, you know, whereby the nobody guy that no one's heard of is, you know, comes up to Edinburgh and, you know, and wows everyone and has that opportunity to perform somewhere and get an audience. That's what I think would be sad if that goes again.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I just feel really sorry for bigger performers who kind of are kind of being pushed into the big four and
because of the money, because the reason they're being pushed there is that, you know, a lot of big agents will obviously have relationships with the big venues, they work with them for years. An agent might also be a promoter, so they will probably charge their client as producing it a management fee. Then there's the money on top with, you know, the deals they might be doing on flyers and a street team and all that. And, you know, certain comedy companies make a lot of money during the fringe. So that's why they're always going to push their artists. No, you've got to do the pleasance. You've got to do the Gilded Balloon. You've got to do the assembly rooms and all that. But I think because there's so many shows, and again, going back to this comedy bubble, most locals on the street, apart from the big household names, have no idea who certain acts are that we both think, oh, wow, oh, he did this, great. No idea. So when they're standing outside the Pleasance and going, do we see this guy who's got 5 stars and was on this TV show and that TV show for £11 on a Saturday? Or can I go here and see this guy who flied me in the street and it's free? I know what show they're going to go and take a risk on. They're going to go to the free, and that's the problem. I think unless you're now what I call a comedian that's done lots of TV and is well known, I don't see the benefit anymore of doing the paid fringe. I just don't see it for that. You know, and there's so many, it's heartbreaking every year when you see artists that you know and like who have got great shows and are going, getting no one in. I don't know, I'm in the big venue, got my posters, got my street team, just got my PR, done loads of press, I just can't get people in. And it comes down to, people don't know who you are enough to go, yeah, I'm going to pay £12 to see you to do a 50-minute show. That's what's such a shame.
Yeah, I think there's no relationship there between you and that audience to even take a punt on them.
Yeah, and exactly.
I'm the same. If someone says to me, like if 3 people say to me, go and see a show that's a paid one, I'll Google them and look up what they do. Mm-hmm. That's until that's happened, I won't bother.
But I've come out of shows, because I always pay for my tickets, because I just...
Oh no! I'm talking about paid.
But
shows,
yeah, that's what I mean. Okay. I'll pay to go and see. Someone you might say, check this guy. Really? I'll take your judgment. Okay, and I'll pay £8-9. I feel cheated if that show's not good enough, not worth £9 now. Yeah. I really, really will. I'll just come out going, can't believe £9 for that. Oh, yeah. Whereas I'll go and see a free show. It might be shit, and I go, all right, hey, I walked out and got to anything. Yeah. And that's the thing. That's the problem. So I just think it's so. There's always going to be enough artists who don't know how Edinburgh works and will always pay someone money to stand on a stage. That's the way it's always going to be. And you know, you mentioned your friend there, £12,000. I've heard people pay more than that.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're told, no, you must have the PR. You must have this. You must have the big adverts that go directly to the council now. I mean, the good old days of paying some dodgy scouse guy to put your posters up in the dead of night. That's what a festival's all about. It's so commercialised, even the posters and this size. You can have this and that and that. And, you know, if you dare to blue tack your poster over one of those, boom, you'll get a call. It's crazy. It's a festival that's just a massive money-making machine.
Yeah, but not always for the artist.
No, very rarely for the artist. Yeah. Unless you sort of, you know, go, this is what I'm, you know, you've got to go, look, if you're a certain artist, you want to develop yourself, Edinburgh's fantastic, you should do it. But don't go in, I'm going to lose £5,000. I see it as investing towards my career. That's what I'm going to do. But people go and think they're going to make money and all that and sort of mortgage their homes to do it. It's very, very sad. Yeah. There's pressure they feel under. They have to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've done 7 other comedy festivals.
Right.
And I'm going to have 3 more after Edinburgh.
Oh, wow, fantastic.
And I just think to myself, you know what, in 4 of, I've just got the money back from the Reading one, so 4 of them, I made a slight profit.
Great.
And I'm just thinking to myself, I'd rather look at it as in I'm working towards getting a show that I can take around to these other festivals that I might make a profit on or I might break even on than go, you know what, Edinburgh I need to make profit on as well, because it's such a capricious festival.
But what comedians don't do, and we all do it, and a stand-up would go, oh, doing a comedy gig tomorrow, £150, great. When you factor in the hours of work and writing and nurturing and travelling, you work that out then per hour, and you know, we're all getting paid less than a cleaner. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Again, it goes back to, it's got to be a love of it.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's got to be, for most performers, it's not a career, it's a vocation. It's a vocation. It's something you just feel you have to do.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And
and found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with people doing it as a hobby. I do have a problem with them doing it as a hobby if it starts. So like we were talking about the open circuit before, like open mic circuit, and I do feel like there are some gigs, especially in the London open mic circuit, that train you to not be good at comedy.
Oh really? I don't really know that world. I remember years ago when you had to have an entry card and it was easier for actors to get it, to get the cabaret one through Spotlight.
Okay.
So, Equity. So you could do less jobs. Like Emma Thompson, that's when she sort of started doing comedy, you know, in the early days, comedy and all that. It's quicker to get an Equity card. So there was loads of sort of, you know, you look back at that sort of alternative, the boom of alternative comedy in 1978, 79, 80, and you look back at where some of them now, loads of them are well-known actors, and that's what they did it. They had a funny character idea, and they went out there and got their equity card to get more acting gigs.
I was in like a small room, he was in the big room, Stuart Lee, and I was saying to him, to me, when you talk about the old days of Edinburgh, that you come up with an idea and you hone it over a month, that sounds really fun.
Yeah.
But he's like, now, I come up with an hour. I have to, because it's the way it works. I don't hone an idea. Yeah. I do it the months beforehand.
But that's from an agent's point of view, and it's like that whole thing that you, when acts do that, the problem is you try and get industry people to see the preview or show, you know, in the first week. Then they develop it. By the end, it's brilliant. And then you go, but you've got to come back and see the show. I've seen it. Yeah, but it's so different now. I've got too many shows. I can't see it. And that's the kind of thing. You've got to hit the ground running. Yeah. You know, from now, day one in Edinburgh now, your show has got to be ready because you never know who's going to wander in.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of surreal. When I did the Hastings Fringe and I did the Reading Fringe, and in those audiences, I got emails the next, like in the week, from people, and I didn't know they're in, and no one asked for comps.
But that's for the free fringe. But the free fringe, you don't.
No.
So if you do the paid show in Edinburgh, press are meant to fill out a comp form, and you go into a little office and go, "Oh, we've got so and so in." But with the free fringe, unless you've got a PR who sort of knows, you've got no idea.
No.
Which I think is better for most performers.
Yeah.
Unless the performer specifically says, I want to know when so-and-so's in, I just don't tell them. I just think, why have that added pressure on yourself?
Yeah.
You've got to be it's funny to some person who they've never met before that may or may not help your career in some way. I just think it's awful pressure.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I've done free fringe the last 3 years I've come up here, and this year I'm on Pay What You Want, which I really like as a concept.
I like as a concept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem is, because it's the first time I've done it, I found when I give them on a flyer, they immediately see £5, and they don't sort of hear, you can come in for free if you wanted to.
I've got it with one show with Chris McLeod, Just a Tonic, and Frankenstein's, we're not part of any institutions, it's just they're free shows, and we sort of toyed with it, and I just thought, I've then got to set up some kind of box office system and bring someone else on board, and then the fringe are going to take a percentage of that money. I just thought, just show up. You can always get into a gig in Edinburgh if you really want to show up and just sort of get in, you know.
Yeah.
And again, the shows that are popular, you get the half hour before, there's a massive queue, and that's great, you know. As a sort of promoter, we love seeing a queue.
Yeah, of course. and it adds to the buzz of the future of the show, because if someone goes, oh, hang on, we're going here, but what's that? There's that psychology thing of like restaurants used to put you in the window first to make it look more packed. So when you come to Edinburgh with clients, do you have something in mind that you want for them as well as what they're after? I mean, how does
it
that
depends where they are. I mean, to many, it will just be to do their first hour and get into that kind of mindset and writing mindset to do it. You know, it might be a club comic who is linking his material from the last 2 years and how you kind of mold it into its show in inverted commas, and how you segue and how you link things. It could be that. It could be someone you just think this is could be the right time for them because, you know, the industry is looking for X, Y, and Z. Let's really go in hard on this. It's a mixture, really. But I say to people, if you don't have a show in you, don't do Edinburgh. Don't get someone to go, you have to do it. Can't you do that? And don't do it. Don't take this aggravation and the cost of it. You come up to Edinburgh when you've got a show inside you and a show you want to do and a show you want to do for 26 days in a row, which is a beautiful thing. You know, that's why you do Edinburgh. You know, if you just got an idea and stuff, do it in London. Do it wherever you live. Just, you know, get a room above a pub and invite, you know, people along. Don't do the whole Edinburgh slog because just someone's told you, oh, you need to be seen to do it. Not true.
Mm. And you talked earlier about having to get the stage time, having to get the hours in and live a life, essentially, to become a better comedian, which is something I completely believe in. And I think, you know, nothing against a 20-year-old comedian, for example, but I do think generally the ones I like are 40 or 50 years old and they just happen to...
It's the only entertainment industry I can think of where... The older you get,
the
more chance you've got at success. I mean, it's bizarre. I know there's the sort of skinny pretty boy kind of thing that certain TV channels will use and whatever, and brands will use. But, you know, if you're a comedy animate like you or me are, it is normally the older men and women that you kind of find more entertaining. You know, I just think of the way it is.
I found it really interesting. There was a comedian who I gigged with very early on who got picked up and was on... quite a big chat show, like they were involved in that. And on their Wikipedia entry, it says, best known for being part of whatever, also does comedy. And I was like, oh, that's got to hurt him. That's got to be uncomfortable because you're like, that's not what he wanted to be. But
when you're young and you don't know and someone says you need to be sued, you don't know, you're really great, you know. Mm. Look, if everyone makes mistakes, you learn from your mistakes.
Well, I don't know if you'd call it a mistake, but you know what I mean? It's just a decision and stuff. And I suppose, I mean, do you... Because like you said, there's sort of some channels that use the young pretty boy and skinny jeans, all that kind of look. I mean, do you think TV is ageist in the wrong direction then?
Of course it is. You know, you just look, it's always been ridiculous for years. You know, you look at the average age of viewers on most channels and they're 45 plus and there's not enough comedy. I work with Jeff Hiddison, who... Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant stand-up, lovely guy, great club comic. You know, and he's we've got some live shows coming up called Comedy for Grown-Ups. And you sort of get in free if you're a certain age. I can't remember what the shtick is. But, you know, and it's just I want to hear a comedian talk about stuff that means something to me rather than getting a 50-year-old man on stage doing stuff about his kids to an 18-year-old audience. It never kind of works. I mean, I don't know. I don't go to many sort of... comedy clubs as much as I used to. I don't know what the average, whenever I go, it always seems to be people kind of in their 30s. I don't think an 18, 19 year old, do they go to comedy clubs? I've no idea. But it is kind of it boils down to kind of finding your audience, really, and finding people who get you. And I think, I don't know, that's always sort of quite a difficult connect, really, just who's on stage and what is the audience and who gets what. That's why certain clubs, my favourite club of all time, Long Deceased with Malcolm Hardy, is the Tunnel Club. I live in North London. We used to drive every Sunday to Deptford to go to the, I think he used to call it the Palladium, the Tunnel Club. And just because it was my kind of person in the audience, you know, that kind of sort of, I would say punk, but certainly irreverent sort of anything goes style. And you knew every week the acts you'd get would be, you'd love them. And I think that's kind of lacking in comedy now with comedy clubs. You know, I started running a night called The Comedy Happening. We did it at the Auburn. It's now transferred to the Soho Theatre. Sort of do it every month, late night show. And again, because I wanted to go back to that kind of club where you're going to see something slightly outrageous that you're never going to see on TV and you're never going to see at Jongleurs. And that's the kind of thing, because I think otherwise you're just seeing so many people doing their, you know, standard observational comedy, and here comes the callback, here comes the you kind of, it's comedy by numbers, really. And I think that's kind of lacking now, but I think that's because of TV and audiences have got used to seeing, you know, heavily edited Live at the Apollo shows and a certain look and whatever. They assume that's what they want to see in TV, and most comedy club owners will say, say sadly, yeah, I have to get from so-and-so's TV show to know that I'm going to sell more tickets tonight. So it's sort of, that's why it's affected so many clubs.
So it's like chicken and egg, really?
Yeah.
Yeah,
because, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, because once you've been on TV, people... But I mean, there are some clubs who say, you know, having a TV name at the headline spot doesn't sell any more or any less tickets. We have...
I think it depends who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know... our first comedy happening, there's me going, oh, this is like the alternative days and all that, and I got a call from someone, Bobby Davo wants to come and try out a new bit, and I went, I can't say no to Bobby Davo. So it was just quite bizarre seeing all this weird stuff and Davo coming out and doing, you know, his old Chris Eubank impression. You know,
yeah. The thing with that is, if you're a club, you're a business, and you do need to know your audience, and you need to sort of pick and choose the comedians that will work with that. So I suppose the extension of that idea would be, if you were a performer who wanted to do something a bit more quirky and you couldn't find a space for it, say at Junglers or Up the Creek or whatever it would be, you could start your own night.
Absolutely. I say to many people, many acts, you know, do it yourself, do a night, put some acts around you. Absolutely. I mean, I used to run comedy clubs when I first started out in the, again, sort of 88, 89, had a little club in North Finchley, which Ian Stone then took over, called the Moss Hall Palladium. And it's fine, because I was, you know, 21 then, and so I was inviting people of 21, and the acts were sort of the same age, and it kind of worked. I couldn't do it now. I'm nearly 50. I couldn't put a weekly club on and expect to get 25, 30. I wouldn't know what they liked and what references. I just wouldn't go there anymore.
Is that because the acts you book are older and you're older?
Yeah,
and
so yeah. I mean, I don't know many 18, 19-year-old comedians, or if I see them, I don't know they're going to make me laugh, because I assume they're going to be talking about stuff that it doesn't resonate to me anymore. It doesn't mean anything anymore. Mm. You know, I don't know. You know, you've got so many comedians, you know, doing Tinder jokes and this joke and this, that. Oh, I'm on this. No idea. I get the craft of the gag, but it doesn't mean anything to me, you know?
Also, I suppose, and I mean this in the nice possible way, you've seen a lot. So as a result, it's kind of...
You do become like that sad muso standing at a gig when you sort of hear a guitar solo and you know, turn to your mate, that's very Mark Bolan, isn't it? Sounds very Bolan-esque. You do the same with comedy. You know, the amount of times I've sat at a gig and nudged someone with, went, that's Harry Hill, that is. Look at that mannerism. Oh, God, he's watched a lot of Eddie Izzard DVDs. And I think that's natural. You know, musicians from Mick Jagger to David Bowie have taken stuff from Little Richard and James Brown. So there's no reason why a comedian who loves Harry Hill and Eddie Izzard won't, by osmosis, take some of their tics and mannerisms. But they haven't found their true voice yet, their true, you know, comedy voice, until they kind of changed it. I mean, you know, Jack D famously was quite a, as he says, quite a fun, outgoing comic, and then one day it was, oh God, I can't be asked to do this, whatever, and they are his persona was created. So sometimes it takes time to find that voice.
Yeah, definitely. And if we were to extend that slightly further, that's where I think online gets really interesting, because you know, if you could only, you only get a certain number of evenings a week that you can gig, but you could make a I could sit down every morning and make a podcast if I wanted to, or I could make a video. You know, they do those on YouTube.
You'd never leave the house, Simon. You'd never get out. You'd literally have. You have no life now, but you'd literally have no life at all.
Matt, I have about four friends in the world that I see, and I see them quarterly individually.
Quarterly.
It's so bad. One of them I texted recently, and literally their reply was, "Is it my turn?"
Oh, bless.
They know I just gig, and all I do is travel. I don't have anything else, because I don't care about anything else, really. So
a traveling minstrel.
Wouldn't go that far. But it's insane. But the thing is, and I don't want to say it like this, but you do give up a lot of stuff for this job, because you know, especially like I do writing work during the day, and then I gig during the evening.
It's all consuming. It's absolutely all consuming.
But I find podcasting gives me personally a bit of a weird release, even though we're talking about comedy and we're talking about the industry.
Yeah.
It's quite nice to have a minute away.
It's your safe space for an hour.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's why. I mean, do you not find that when you're doing the football podcast, that you get your
act? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You just definitely, without a doubt.
Yeah. So and that's where I think the passion comes from. In that, you know, like you said, a lot of comedians do that thing where they're just, you know, oh, podcast big, I'll get an audience from that. And in reality, it's not that easy.
No.
I was going to say, what do you think it takes to be a good agent?
Oh dear.
It's 9 a.m., mate. Let's not start with this.
Well, I think you've got to be personable. You've got to be tough when you have to be. Honest. with your client and people you're working with. I think a good ear, you've got to listen, see what people need. Proactive rather than reactive. It's very easy to get so much work, you're just reacting to calls rather than, no, let's think bigger picture. Let's think about projects, you know, like in companies, marketing companies, always thinking ahead about things. And I, you know, I think that's a skill that you need. I don't know, really. I mean, I just think you need to speak to artists about it, what they need from their agent. Communication, I mean, this is at the top of the show. It's amazing how many actor friends I've got who goes, oh, I never speak to my agent. No, I might, you know, hear once every 6 months and whatever. And I'm like, really, why? Go for a coffee, have a chat. So I think, you know, you need to sort of, you need to get on with them, really, and get on with your clients. You know, I can't represent people I don't like. I can't do it. I, you know, there's, you know, over the years, there've been certain clients with the phone ring. You see their name come up, and you just go, oh God, oh. And you thought, this is wrong. If that's what you're, you should be, oh great, hey, how are you? You know, you've all got certain people. You go, oh God, when the name comes up, you can't. I don't want that in my life.
Yeah, you know? No, life's too short.
Exactly.
You don't need that. We were talking about the circuit a little bit and how that sort of contracted, but also the number of comedians have gone up. Mm. Do you think it's actually possible for, let's just, whichever comedian you're thinking about right now, to make a living off the circuit still?
No. Okay. Just off the circuit? Yeah. It depends what you call a living, but, you know, if you just do your Friday, Saturdays and a Thursday maybe in here and there, I think you can survive, but, you know, you need to factor in that you'll get the odd corporate gig, the odd, I don't know, commercial maybe. We're looking for some funny people and this and that and that. You know, you always, I saw Imran Yusuf was on an advert this morning. I turned the TV on, it was some thing. I was like, oh, that's, well, you know, doing some ad, you know. You need these things to supplement your stagecraft. Until you can tour, I think, on your own right, or be a support on a big tour where you've got regular money coming over 30, 40 dates or whatever, doing gigs abroad and whatever. I think you look at the very successful club comics, they're what, doing 2, 3, 4 gigs on a Friday and a Saturday? It's constant. They have to do that much to bring the money in.
Mm.
You know, so there's not that many doing that, I don't think, anymore.
And why do you think that is?
Because the clubs aren't there. Okay. You know, you look at the... I used to work for Jongleurs years ago for their management arm in 98, 99. You know, they had 7, 8 clubs then. I don't know. I mean, I know it's broken up now with Entertain and Daryl running the old... The Dingwalls in Camden. But there's just less clubs. I mean, there's the Glee and there's some great clubs out there. But a lot have gone by the wayside because ultimately a club survives by the amount of people coming and the amount of beer they sell. You know, that's it. You know, and especially in London, rent and rates have gone up tremendously. So if you're just, you know, and again, it's identity. Is there any 6, 7 day a week comedy venue? There's a comedy store. Yes, I think that's all. And maybe 99 Club every day, or they top secret, they like might do little Monday Tuesdays, but there's very few that can operate 5, 6 days a week just on comedy anymore.
We're just talking London, or are we talking
probably anywhere, really? I mean, I used to run my background was running venues. I had what was then the Cockney on Tottenham Court Road, which turned into the Improv Club when I took it over. And we were flying over American Comics on a Friday and a Saturday, and I went, this ain't gonna work. And then all of a sudden we put, you know, wrestling in there, live music, anything to sustain it. I mean, the only sort of clubs I can think of where you know what you're gonna see every single night is a lap dancing club. It's the only club you know any day of the week. Mm. Most clubs now, you know, Monday salsa night, Tuesday open spots, you know, Wednesday bingo, and that's it. So you can't just show up. You know, I love Soho and I love the history of Soho. You'd walk into a speakeasy, you know, whatever it was, the Flamingo, and know the kind of music you're going to hear every kind of night. That's sadly sort of gone. I mean, there's a few, God bless the Comedy Store, place like that, that are still doing it, but there's not many out there anymore.
When it comes to, say you had a client who, for whatever reason, you know, could be that they just don't have the room for them, or they're just not interested in them, or whatever, couldn't get on TV or radio or anything that would mainstreamly push them forward.
Mm.
How would you go about finding their audience without the assistance of...
Well, in a way, it has helped because of the whole YouTube internet stuff and podcasting. I mean, that was it. You know, years gone by when you turn around to... And again, there's still not many comedy people you've got to deal with when BBC... to a lesser degree ITV, Channel 4, Sky go, no, we, whatever reason, we don't want to use that person, or we've got something similar and all that. What do? You have to develop. You have to write for others, do stuff on the internet, tour, find other outlets for your comedy. And I think in a way, people having to adapt and change, I think, is a good thing. You know, I mean, you know, again, with access, the days of the actor sitting at home waiting for the agent to ring are long gone. You've got to go out and find your own work and develop your own work and find a scene and a crowd that likes you. You can't just wait for it to happen. It goes back to the top thing about how you work together. It's got to be collaborative. You've got to work together on it. You can't just sit and just go, oh, so no one wants to book me then, what am I going to do? We'll get off your arse and try and think of something else.
And if one of your clients comes to you with an idea going, I would love to develop a YouTube series, or I'd love to develop a podcast or whatever, how, you said that like it's kind of, like obviously podcasts you're quite strong in because you've got that sort of network and you've been in it for a while. Like how do you advise them in such a different medium to life?
Try it, you know. You're the king of the pods. You know how it works.
Using that one,
you know,
fucking try
it.
Poster.
You know, do exactly. You know, do a pilot show. Send it to mates. Listen. Get feedback. What do you like? What didn't you like? You know, what, you know, any ideas? And just like any, like a set on stage, you develop it, you nurture it until you get something. The great thing about podcasts is you get instant people liking it and whatever, and this is great, and feedback. It's like any creative process. It is a process, you know, and you get it to a level that you're happy with, and then look, critically and financially it becomes a success, even better. But you know, not everything artistic has to have a commercial worth to it. You know, again, you're in the wrong business if that's why you're doing it.
Yeah, no, I'd completely agree with that. So when you take on a client and you've seen them live, say for example, and obviously you would like them to get on a radio or a TV or just do something that would make the profile higher. Say you manage to get them on a panel show or do stand up live or whatever it would be, and they were not as good there as they are live.
Well, they're not. I mean, again, you speak to most TV producers of comedy panel shows, and they'll tell me loads of times a well-known comic gets on a panel show and just thinks, I'm so-and-so, I'm now going to sit on this desk. Where's my money? Where's my 5-10 grand? And it's like, no, this is a different medium. You've got to chip in at the right time. You've got to learn where the camera is and whatever, weights, whatever that, come out with the funny quips. It's all going to be in the edit. Everything's going to be edited down. Things filmed for 3-4 hours. I want you working for the 4 hours, not just sit there like, well, I've got this gig because I won the Perrier, whatever it's called now, the lastminute.com.
Everyone's,
you know, just
Perrier,
sit there going, I'm going to do it. They won't get booked for another panel show. You know, the ones that know how panel show works will end up on a lot of them because they give that producer and the director what they want to see on that show. And that's it. So it'd be a nice one-off fee, but you want it to be more than just a one-off fee. You want it to be a regular thing, and you want to get to the stage and you go, I think you've done enough panel shows this year. Let's just, you know, what a bit shit, aren't they? Let's just, you know, you've done a few now, your profile's gone up. It means now you're developing your tour. We can put that there. That's going to help sell tickets. But, you know, don't become just known for panel shows, which obviously so many comedians have over the years.
But that's probably why, because there's a lot of, you know, I've heard loads of my four friends say things like, oh, how come they're only the same like 12 people you see on
the
panel
shows? That's because supposedly comedy TV producers and directors think they're good, but also that's because of the absolute laziness of bookers and producers who book talent, who again would look at certain agencies, certain names, or they're being put under pressure. You want to book so-and-so, you've got to book so-and-so for this, and all that stuff goes on. They'll just be lazy. They don't, I mean, you know, there's very few comedy producers I know that will go out to seek out obscure stuff at the Fringe and all that. They'll just come up for the last couple of days. Who shall I see at the Pleasance? Who shall I see at the Gorda Balloon? Who shall I see? Who's got the big posters? What shall I go and see? What's the buzz? Buzz, everyone's got their own buzz. I mean, you know, that's the, you know, the, again, because the amount of shows. I mean, the last time I, again, show my age, but, and, you know, I'm sure there's been many since. The last time I truly remember a real buzz from the Fringe, and I was working for the company that was promoting at the time, that someone came about that no one ever heard of and it went, oh my God, it's so different. It was probably Johnny Vegas. That year he did his first show at the Gilded Balloon, the old Gilded Balloon, which is now sort of part of, I don't know, it's a free fringe venue or whatever, the bit that burnt down. That was just, no one had seen this guy from Manchester do this weird rant, like having a nervous breakdown on stage while making pottery. I mean, it was just the bizarrest thing. That was the last time the industry was like, you've got to see this guy, you've got to see this guy. Now there's so many shows, you get a buzz. It's funny now already, day one, you'll hear a little buzz about something. And then the week after, that's gone, there's a buzz about someone else. Because there's so many shows, there is no big buzz anymore. Mm. You know, and I think, you know, Comedy Awards, you know, comedy is so subjective. I mean, I've sat and seen winners and nominees and I'm scratching my head going, I don't get this, I don't get, you know, but it's subjective. And I never quite understand why, and I've mentioned this to them before, I never quite understand why they don't allow comedy agents on the panel. I you know, they go, oh, because your vote, well, obviously we're not going to vote for our own artists, we won't be allowed to, but your book comedy producers who are want to sign up talent and do deals, what's the difference? They're looking to sign people up in some way. Why are they allowed to supposedly know their comedy, and agents who see it every single day are not allowed to make comment on other people? You know, come on, we're many nice people. Mm. We're not going to, you know, deliberately stiffer rivals at if they think it's a brilliant show. Yeah. Why aren't they allowed to come and be seen, or even ex-agents, whatever, who've had that background, to go and see? Because we watch a lot of comedy and we know what's derivative, we know what's original, you know, we know what's clever, we know what's groundbreaking, we know what's taking risks. And isn't that what comedy should be all about, especially live?
They had that, didn't they? The BBC got criticised. They did the YouGov survey where like, I don't know, 80% or 90% of the people that took it said, we want the BBC to take more risks with comedy, because right. it's all becoming
But okay, there's less of them now, most of freelance, but again, you know, comedy producers at the BBC in-house are paid quite well, and do they want to jeopardise that pay by bringing something in that people go, what have you done? What is this guy? What have you put in? They'd rather keep it safe, keep it simple, keep them the pay packet, and keep in there, you know, don't raise their head above the pulpit. That's it. That is why.
And
I kind of understand it. I see it. There's something wrong in that. But that's why people don't take risks. The channels don't take risk anymore. They can't. They don't think they can afford to.
No. And in like you said, in a certain way, I understand that. Because if you've got a job and you've got a family, yeah. You've got commitments, mortgages, or anything.
You know, the amount of, over the years, we're going to do something different. Like, it's going to be like the old Friday night Saturday Night Live. We're going to do this. We're going to have this. Oh, yeah, we're on this. Well, the next minute, it's like, we need the big household name to host it. Excuse me, but you're going to do... Well, yeah, but we think we need Sansa to host it. So actually, we're going to get some bands on now that are quite well known and sing. And it just, the whole thing just changes again.
Yeah.
And that always happens.
Well, these are quick fire last questions, if that's all right. Quick fire for me. Take as long as you want, but yeah, I understand. Well, I'll ask you the question that I was going to ask you at the start then. What is the best show you've ever seen?
In the Fringe?
I keep it deliberately vague. Oh, TV show.
Well, wow. Bloody show. Hell. That's over the best I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, like any Animat, there isn't just one. Ones that stick out as a kid seeing Spike Milligan live at the, Dominion. See Billy Connolly live somewhere in London when I was a kid. That was amazing. The Johnny Vegas one I mentioned a while back when he first hit Edinburgh. Amazing. The League of Gentlemen, the year they won that. That was lovely and refreshing to see when they won that show. Non-comedy, there was a play in Edinburgh, Hurricane, at the Assembly Rooms, which was about one-man show about Alex Higgins, the snooker player. That was a real tour de force, as they say. That blew my mind. Oh, God, there's so many. I mean, that's the ones just off the top of my head.
That's right. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you overcome it?
Oh my God, biggest mistake I ever made.
I love at the top of the
list. I'll tell you what it is, getting into this fucking industry. Must be mental, mental. That was the biggest mistake I ever made.
That's a soundbite. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions about what you do?
But what we do, that don't trust your agent, they're sharks. That's all about the money. They'll do a deal if it suits them. All that utter nonsense. You can't keep, you know, I've been doing this now, oh God, 17, 18 years. You know, you can't do it that way. Many do, and many disappear. There's always these sort of shining lights. These people who come forward, and you come in, and they sort of fall by the wayside because they're just not very good at it and not in it for the right reasons. Mm. I think any kind of long term thing, you've got to have a love for it. You really do. I've met very few agents that you think you've no interest in your clients. You're all about the deal. Most love the people they work with and love the industry.
Mm, definitely. Who do you think is the most underrated person in the comedy industry?
Wow, good question. I think there's a multitude of difference. I think small club owners, the ones who sort of promoters that I, you know, still do a little bit of, people who promote who will get a room above a pub and work out they're going to pay their artists a fixed fee of, or agree on a door split, and no fucker shows up, and they're the ones out of their pocket. Not only are they working for free, that night's actually costing them money. I think that's lovely. I think they, to keep the comedy industry going, that's the grassroots that cannot die. So I think they're the kind of unsung heroes that barely get a mention. It was really sweet, actually. I went to the Scottish Comedy Awards a couple of nights ago at Le Monde, and there was various awards, and they were doing awards for, you know, best small club and big club and all that. It was lovely to hear these sort of small clubs getting the recognition, the comedians going, yeah, you know, whatever, you gave them a first chance. I think those people, I think, are fantastic. Because they do it for the love, they're not doing it for the money. They are, they're stupid.
What do you think's the biggest problem in the comedy industry, and how would you go about solving it?
Biggest, wow. Good question. You've done these ones before, haven't you?
Yeah.
Hype is, you know, something which is always works in show business, and I've got a lot of good friends who work in PR, and I know it's all smoke and mirrors and hype, but sometimes that can be annoying when I think certain comics are getting ahead rather than other more talented ones because of certain hype around them. That kind of, you know, annoys me, really. That still, I know it's always happened, but it happens even more so now, that certain people we push and you're like, there's nothing behind you, come on. Mm. But that happens a lot. What was the question again? Because I might have another one for
it
you.
It was
what else annoys you?
What's the biggest mistake? Sorry, what's the biggest problem in the comedy industry, and how would you go about solving it?
Okay, so that was the one, the hype, and the other one again, the biggest problem is live venues that can nurture artists that are ready to perform, to ready to develop. You know, I mean, you talk about the Arts Council and funding, and they, you know, I know it's cutbacks, but they still fund a lot of money. When you read about what goes into the comedy industry, what's, you know, I know Soho Theatre do great work with certain groundbreaking writing, that's a case in point, but actual like proper comedy clubs that people can go in, maybe like community centres that are going to do the stuff that will do subsidised comedy teaching, how to write, how to just be more confident as a person, whatever the sort of angle you need to use to get the money. I think that would be lovely to sort of see, you know, we've got such a great British tradition of comedy. We're still one of the greatest exporters and purveyors of comedy. And it worries where the next wave of true greats are going to come if you don't give them that opportunity and chance to perform and take risks. I think that's a real concern.
Okay, and last question. If you had one bit of advice for a comedian who wants to get an agent, what would it be?
Think why you need an agent. What do you need an agent for? If you just need more gigs, that's it, and you think you're a level, you want more gigs, there's booking agents. There's people that will just find you little gigs and book them if that helps. You know, if you're a level where, right, I now want to write for others, I know what I want to do, I know I'm good enough, then, you know, speak to agents who will hopefully give you the time of day and kind of help, really. You know, I think with this industry, and you don't know because it's developing, I think there's so many comedians on the circuit who are potentially great writers but not great performers, and there's some comedians on the circuit who I think are great performers but not great writers. Collaborate, speak to writers, people you like, you know, collaborate with other people. Let's sort of share the love a bit in this industry and work together, you know. And I think more of that, I think, would be good. And maybe a good agent can help with you collaborating with others and people you get on well with and working together, rather than this comedy being such an insular, no, me, I'm at home, and he's nicked my gag, and all that stuff that goes on, you know.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Simon.
That was Mike. I have got a lot of time for anyone who goes out on their own to work for themselves, knows where they're going and what they want to do and what they like, and believes in the power of community and connecting with people over the internet through free content. And he is all free, which meant I loved chatting to him, and I found the podcast network idea really interesting. It's something I wanted to do for a while, but it's not something I've quite found the right place for this podcast. And, I've got control issues, which means I totally like remaining independent as well. But I just love the idea of networks working together. It means there's a community of creators creating better content for the different audiences they have. It just makes sense. If you got any value out of this, please do share with a friend who might also enjoy it. It really helps out with the downloads, which means that we get more downloads, which means that when guests ask, which is few and far between, but when they ask what numbers I get, it means I can brag about them a bit, which means they get impressed and then they want to come on, and it just helps out. So if you're impressed by the caliber of guests I'm getting on and you want to help it out, please, please pass on the message of the podcast or recommend a show. If you particularly like this one, do that. If you'd like to tweet Mike and say thank you, please do. All of his details are in the show notes. It's nice to be nice. So this industry could use more positivity going around. So please do thank him if you've enjoyed this and got any value out of it. Also, Christmas is coming. Why not plug my book, Simon? My book is on sale on Amazon. It is £5. It's called How to Make a Living by Working for Free. And it's all about building an online audience for your content. And it has extra information that this podcast didn't. It goes into detail and it has interviews with performers who have already done it. And it's got loads of information in it. So if you'd like to support me and you want to buy a copy of the book, you can do that there. That would be really appreciated. And also, consider it your donation for the podcast. If you wanted to donate and you want something for your money, buy a book. You can buy it on my website as well, simoncane.co.uk/shop. If you're new here, please do hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do consider giving us an honest review in iTunes. And either way, if you'd like to give a donation just to keep the show going, this show lives or dies on donations and the support of the community of the listeners. So if you have £1 to say thank you for this episode, just £1, I'd massively appreciate it. If everyone did it, we would be somewhere towards breaking even. So if you can't afford it, don't donate. If you can spare £1 and it's just sitting in your PayPal doing nothing, send it my way. I would really appreciate it. At simoncane.co.uk. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for donating. And thank you very much for sharing if you do. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. If you'd like to contact me about anything related to the show, you can tweet me at thismademecool or email me simon.m.caine@gmail.com. And I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.